Hi, everybody. This is Gary Sandy, and thank you very much for listening to the WKRP cast.
So just sit right down, relax, open your ears real wide, and say...
Weather today in the greater Cincinnati area.
Are you awake? Whoa! Are you awake now?
But the senator, while insisting he was not intoxicated, could not explain his nudity.
Say what?
Dear God, she's going to kill us all.
Welcome to the WKRP cast. My name is Donna Stair.
And I'm her husband, Alan. This is a week-by-week, episode-by-episode rewatch. We're getting into the music,
the trivia,
and the fun of WKRP.
So, fellow babies, don't touch that dial. It's time for the WKRP cast.
I'm at WKRP in Cincinnati.
Welcome back to another WKRP cast. Stick 'em up. Donna, what is our episode?
We're ready to discuss Nothing to Fear But. The air date was March 28th, 1981. Story by Mr. Tim Reed. Teleplay by Dan Gunselman. Story editor, Lisa Levin. Executive story consultants, Steve Marshall and Dan Gunselman. Directed by Asad Kalata. While Johnny does a night stint on the radio, the station is robbed. No one is hurt, but a lot of the expensive items are taken. Mr. Carlson has a security system installed, and everyone starts being paranoid.
Asad Kalata is back as our director. Asad was a huge directing force in the first season of the show. He will direct a total of 15 WKRP episodes. 12 of those were in the 1978-79 season. The last time we saw Asad was when he helmed the classic Fish Story at the end of season one. So what happened to Asad? Well, with the show potentially canceled, or at least that's what everyone thought back at the season wrap in March of 1979, Asad was approached for other work. Producer Gary David Goldberg, who had worked with Asad on The Tony Randall Show, had developed a new MTM show that was ready to go for the fall of 79 called The Last Resort.
The Last Resort was set in a Catskill summer resort. It followed the antics of a diverse group of college students who work there during the summer months. No, this was not Family Ties. Goldberg would go on to better stuff, but it is remembered as being smart and funny.
This young man took a summer job in this plush resort hotel, but he never expected this. Working in a crazy hotel kitchen with a bushy maitre d' and a touchy cook, it's The Last Resort, premiering Wednesdays this fall on CBS.
We're looking good.
The Last Resort got an initial order of 15 episodes, which would turn out to be the entire run of the series. Amazingly, Asad Kalata directed all 15 Last Resort episodes throughout the fall of 1979 and into the spring of 1980. Once Last Resort wrapped, Asad was not hurting for work. He directed an episode of One Day at a Time, four episodes of The Two of Us, an episode of something called Park Place, and now he will do three more episodes of WKRP. This one, and then two more in the fourth season. Welcome back to director Asad Kalata.
The title of this one is taken from an FDR quote, kinda. In his January of 1933 inauguration speech, Roosevelt was addressing a populace freaked out by the economy and Germany. His exact quote was,
"Let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself."
There have been numerous variations and misquotes over the years. Nothing to fear is a common one.
Let's get into the episode. We're starting out in the studio. We've already talked about The Clash and the U2 boy cutout, so we've only got one quick update on the posters.
Yay! The bearded man in the blue shirt playing the Fender Stratocaster over the Cincinnati map is Eric Clapton. This is a 20x30 promo poster for his album Another Ticket. This poster has been modified. in the dark area to the right of Clapton, just above the guitar neck, someone has written in white, "Get well soon." It's going for about $15, but the ones we saw on eBay did not contain the "get well" message. The message looks like it might be an on-set joke.
We open on a darkened studio with "Rock Me Baby" by Otis Redding playing out over the air. The door opens and Johnny enters. He has a wet blue towel on his head and he's unsteady on his feet.
You can rock me, baby. Baby, rock me all night long.
He closes the door behind him and squeezes water from the towel onto the floor. He shakily gets into the chair and pulls the mic over.
Girl, you can rock me all night long now.
All right, bright-eyed babies. That was Dominique Canique from The Singing Nun.
Johnny didn't recognize Otis Redding. He is very ill, or you mentioned hungover,
maybe,
possibly.
I don't know.
The doctor misidentified the song as Dominica. Dominica is possibly the most unique one-hit wonder to ever reach number one on the U.S. charts. It was performed by a Belgian nun entirely in French. That sounds like the makings of a hit, doesn't it?
Dominique, Nique, Nique, s'en allait tout simplement. Routier, pauvre et chantant. En tout chemin, en tout lieu, il ne parle que du bon Dieu. Il ne parle que du bon Dieu. À l'époque où Jean sans terre d'Angleterre était le roi, Dominique, notre père, combattit les Albigeois. Dominique, Nique, Nique.
It spent 4 weeks at number one in November of 1963, and it got her a spot on The Ed Sullivan Show. In the U.S., the artist was listed only as The Singing Nun. Her real name was Jeannie Paul Marie Deckers, but she went by Janine Deckers.
When Janine was 26, she joined the Dominican Order in Belgium. Her religious name was Sister Luc Gabriel. As a nun, she performed songs she'd written around the convent. Her performances were so popular, her superiors encouraged her to record an album. It was intended as a fundraiser. They wanted to sell a few copies to church visitors. She recorded the album that would become known as The Singing Nun in Brussels at Philips Sound Studios in 1962. By the end of 1963, she'd appeared on Ed Sullivan, had a number one U.S. hit, and the album had sold 2 million copies.
Quite a year for Janine. As a nun, Janine had taken a vow of poverty. This meant she received no payment from her music or the very inaccurate 1966 film of her life, starring Debbie Reynolds. The Order, on the other hand, could get paid. They're said to have received more than $100,000 in royalties from the Dominique single alone. Janine left the Order in 1966 penniless. She was also restricted from using either The Singing Nun or Sister Smile as a stage name. Sister Smile, or Sœur Sourire in French?
I don't know. Soiree?
It was another stage name. It was what she used in France. She attempted both recording and performing with no success after she left the convent. Sadly, poverty and depression eventually caused Janine to commit suicide in March of 1985.
Wow. Yeah. We find out it's about 5 a.m.
This is the doctor sitting in for your favorite all-night man and mine, Moss Steiger. We sure miss him, don't we? What do we got here? Oh, yeah.
Johnny flips through the live binder, then begins reading from one of the scripts. It's a station promo for a contest.
Say, WKRPites, it's that lucky KRP Winnekeen portable radio time when yours truly, insert name here.
Johnny slams the binder shut, and he decides to wing it.
He didn't pre-read that copy.
I'll tell you what, babies, I'm just going to level with you. We got about 50 of these 100-pound bodybuilder model portable radios, and You put them up on the shoulder, you wander into a crowd of people who have no interest in your musical taste. They'll part like the Red Sea, believe me. We're really looking to unload them quick, you know what I mean? So, anybody who recognizes at least three of the many obscene words in this next tune, give me a call and you could stagger out of here with one of those in your hand if you can carry it. And we're going to stay right into the promised solid hour of the very solid late great Otis Redding. And remember, I'm standing by my phones. Let me hear those obscene words.
Johnny starts playing Love Man by Otis Redding.
Sounds like Johnny is doing an Otis block. If you remember, he ended A Simple Little Wedding with an Otis tune. So this makes three in a row for the show. Rock Me Baby is a blues standard originally made famous by B.B. King in 1964. Love Man has the distinction of being Redding's last charted single. It hit the charts in 1969, about 18 months after his death in a plane crash. Love Man would go to number 72 in May of 1969. And as far as we can tell, there are no obscene words in either song.
Hey, remember when the neighbor kid would hoist an enormous chrome box full of electronics on his shoulder and walk down the street with his own personal soundtrack blaring?
I sure do.
He was sharing his music with anyone who stood closer than 200 yards. Certain romantics are trying to portray the era of the boombox as a time of public music sharing. Don't be fooled by the nostalgia. Anyone who lived through it knows boomboxes were a loud and annoying part of the 1980s. Although, according to a Collector's Weekly article titled How Boomboxes Got So Badass, the contraptions are credited with giving birth to hip-hop and breakdancing. The appeal of the boombox to urban adolescents earned it the derisive moniker Ghetto Blaster.
Oh, stewardess, I speak jive.
Oh, good.
The forerunner to the monster boomers of the 80s is a 1969 product from Philips called the Radio Recorder. It was the first all-in-one cassette player recorder that allowed direct recording from the radio. Prior to the radio recorder, you needed wires, equipment, and know-how to record anything off-air. The first box to really look like a true boombox came from JVC in 1975. The RC550 was a monster with a 10-inch woofer and even lights, but it wasn't stereo. The JVC RCM90 was a stereo boombox with an awesome look. The M90 is so iconic, it was featured on the cover of LL Cool J's 1985 album, Radio. It's currently considered a prized collectible, and it can go for up to $800 on eBay.
Some did add CD players. Panasonic, Sony, Sanyo, Hitachi, Marantz, GE, and more joined JVC with bigger and louder units. At the height of the craze, you could find boomboxes as wide as 30 inches, weighing up to 26 pounds, and requiring 10 D-cell batteries. They were very portable, which made them easy to steal.
They had a handle right on the top.
The high-end units were eventually so expensive, one model, the Canyon C100F, included a motion detector and an alarm that would go off if the box was moved by an unauthorized user.
Dude's got my boombox. Whoop, whoop, whoop. By the early 1990s, the reign of the boombox, thankfully, was almost over. Sony had introduced a product in 1979 called the Walkman. Oops, it was the anti-boombox. a personal portable cassette player that delivered music through headphones instead of huge speakers. As boomboxes were being banned on buses, subways, and in public parks, basically anywhere people gathered, the Walkman was gaining market share. By 1989, 10 years after its introduction, Sony had sold more than 100 million of the players worldwide. The Walkman and Discman, later renamed the CD Walkman because people weren't figuring out that they were the same product, and devices like them would muscle out boomboxes to own the personal music sector throughout the 90s. The Walkman era would be unchallenged until Apple introduced a little thing they called the iPod.
And I had a Walkman.
Oh, I had Walkman. I had the Discman. I had stuff strapped to my hip for like 18 years there with those little headphones. And always you had to watch. You couldn't swing your arms if you were walking, or you had to be careful, or you were going to rip those headphones right off your head.
Now, Johnny mentioned parting a crowd like the Red Sea. He's going biblical with this one. Check out the 1956 Charlton Heston film, The Ten Commandments, for Hollywood's take on what happened.
Behold his mighty hand!
For an eyewitness-written account, check out the Book of Exodus, chapter 14 in the Holy Bible. The event is also described in the Quran.
As Johnny is moving things around on the desk, his back to the window, we see a dark figure look in the window and then hurry on by. Johnny's pulling carts when he sees the strobe telling him there's a phone call. As he reaches for the phone, another dark figure runs past the window in the same direction as the first one.
Andy is on the phone. Johnny asks what he's doing up at 5.07 a.m.
He's listening, huh? Great. How do I sound? Wow. Congratulations. No, just by your very words, I think you've won yourself a radio, pal.
Sounds like Andy did not enjoy the live read about the radio giveaway. Johnny hangs up the phone, not too worried about Andy's displeasure. He picks up his coffee mug and he heads out of the studio.
In the bullpen, the lights are all out. We can hear from the monitor Otis Redding singing loudly. We see two dark figures rummaging around, going through the drawers. The door to the studio hallway opens and Johnny walks in. Now, it's pitch black, so Johnny is focused on going to the coffee machine. The two figures quickly duck down behind the desk.
Johnny goes to the coffee machine, fills his mug, and then walks out through the glass doors. The two dark figures raise up. Either Johnny got lost or he didn't really quite know where he was going. I don't know. But he turns around. He comes back into the bullpen and the figures duck down again. Johnny crosses the bullpen oblivious and he heads back out the way he came in. The figures raise up and continue their rummaging. And as the robbery continues, we head into our theme.
WKRP in Cincinnati.
We come back from break in the lobby. Jennifer and Les enter the lobby, ready to start the day. Les is rambling on about this dream he had.
Walter and Dan and Harry and Morley and Mike all looked up at me with their eyes bulging out like little baby pigs and pleaded, "Please, Mr. Nessman, please, Mr. Award winner, please don't come to New York and put us newsmen out of work."
Jennifer asked what Les told them. Well, Les says he never speaks in his dreams.
That's just how I am.
Of course you are.
Les heads to the bullpen, chuckling. Jennifer walks over to her desk, picks up her phone cover, only to discover there's no phone. Confused, she stands looking at her desk with nothing on it.
When Les talks newsmen, he stays on brand. He normally only references CBS newsmen. We've talked about most of these guys in the past. Walter would be the venerable dean of CBS News, Walter Cronkite. He hosted the CBS Evening News from 1962 until 1981. Dan would be the guy who took Walter's chair in 1981. Dan Rather. Rather will stay at the big desk through 2005. Harry, Morley, and Mike are the gang from CBS News Magazine 60 Minutes. Harry Reasoner, Morley Safer, and Mike Wallace. Interesting tidbit about Dan Rather. Dan invented the concept of the radar weather report in 1961. While working at a local TV station in Texas, he laid a transparent map over a radar image of Hurricane Carla. His inspiration and quick thinking prompted the successful evacuation of 350,000 people.
Yay, Dan.
That is impressive.
Oh, and according to the Dream Doctor at dreamdoctor.com, if you can't speak or communicate in your dreams, it reflects a feeling you aren't being heard in your waking life. This might tell us something about Mr. Nessman.
Do you speak in your dreams?
I don't know if I do.
I'm going to try to pay attention next time.
I'm not sure. I don't know if I have audio in my dreams. I think my dreams are only video.
Oh, really?
I don't recall hearing things in my dreams.
They're not talkies then.
Yeah,
huh?
No, they're not. I mean, my dreams came out before talkies.
Les enters the bullpen. He removes his coat and hat, hangs them on the rack. He's singing The Great Pretender as he does this.
Yes, I'm the great pretender. Pretending that you're still around.
And now a special look at this episode's bandage placement for the 5-time Buckeye Newshawk Award winner, Les Nessman. This is the Les Nessman Bandage Report. Now, here's Donna Stair with her report about Les Nessman.
Right earlobe.
This has been a look at the bandage placement for Silver Sow and Copper Cub award-winning journalist, Les Nessman.
He walks over to his office, taking keys out of his pocket as he approaches his office door. He unlocks the door and walks into his office.
Now, you remember we saw Les about to lock his door one night, and Andy was in the bullpen, and he thought better of it. He did
right.
not pull actual keys out.
I remember, and I don't think Andy was the only one there. I think there were some other people there, too.
Yeah, he kind of made this decision, I don't think I'd better do it in front of people, but here he yeah. very grandly pulls out the keys and unlocks that door.
Well, still singing as he walks into his office, he tears the yellow tear sheet from the machine and sits down at his desk. He takes a sheet of paper and turns to where his typewriter should be. There's no typewriter. Les stares at the empty space for a moment, then panics.
Les was singing The Great Pretender from 50s doo-wop group The Platters. It was an original written by Platters manager Buck Ram. Ram says he needed a follow-up to their smash Only You. When he had the idea, he said it took him 20 minutes to write the song, and he wrote it in the bathroom of the Las Vegas Flamingo Hotel. It was recorded in November of 1955.
Oh, yes, I'm the great pretender. Pretending that I'm doing well. My need is such, I pretend. One can tell.
By February of 1956, The Great Pretender was the number one song in the country.
That was a great 20 minutes spent.
Very well spent in the bathroom. It's ranked at number 360 on the Rolling Stone list of the 500 greatest songs of all time.
Johnny enters from the studio hallway door and he greets Les. Les stands up, which brings us to
the line of the episode.
Johnny, my space has been violated.
Congratulations, it's about time.
Les turns to his awards that hang on the wall, and he's touching all of them, very relieved to see that they are there.
His children.
Johnny is waving his hand through the space where the coffee pot usually is. He asks Les where the coffee pot is. Les says he doesn't know and that someone has taken his typewriter.
Hey, man. There's a whole lot of stuff missing.
Good golly.
Les, I hate to say this, but I think we have been robbed.
Johnny walks over to Les's office.
Somebody must have jimmied the lock.
Jimmy did. I think they took the whole door.
Johnny's waving his hands around in Les's office door space.
They took the whole door. So we transition to the lobby, Mr. Carlson and Herb enter, and oh my goodness,
it's time.
Herb Darlick, fashion alert.
We've seen this suit before, but it is a doozy. Herb is wearing a brown mustard yellow colored dress shirt with yellow lines running all through it to give it a checkered look. His suit coat and pants are a matching plaid made up of several colors. We can see brown, tan, orange, red, yellow, and green. He's wearing a solid white tie, white belt, and his white shoes. It is a sight to behold.
It seems like it's moving independently of him. When he walks in the room, he stops, but the suit is still in motion. So Herb is talking excitedly to Art.
Six kind of meats, seven kind of cheeses, and little tiny olives placed in the shape of the station call letters. Unlimited champagne, not too expensive. A bartender, and for class, a coat check girl in a very short skirt.
He asks Mr. Carlson, is that the perfect party or what?
Yeah. Who was there?
Herb tells Art, this is what he's planning for them for this Friday night. Art looks confused. Herb tells him, they're having a party. Every ad agency in town has been invited. He rented the banquet room downstairs.
You approved this weeks ago.
Mr. Carlson is trying his hardest to remember.
Every ad man in the city will be there. Don't you remember?
Oh, yeah, of course I do.
Carlson laughs and claps his hands together. Herb begins laughing, too. He tells Mr. Carlson he had him going.
You know, old Herbie was completely fooled by your dumb act.
Herb pats Mr. Carlson on his shoulder and heads back to the bullpen.
That's pretty good, wasn't it?
From a real-world radio standpoint, Herb's party is 100% accurate. I attended several of these kinds of events when I was at the ad agency. You attended a few of them with me.
Oh, yeah.
And unless you possibly blotted them out of your memory because they were so boring, they would be tied to a station milestone and they'd throw a party like an anniversary or a change in format. They might also be a seminar or a speaker sponsored by the station, but with information that would be beneficial to an ad agency. No matter what the excuse was for the event, there would always be a great buffet and an open bar. Usually with the speakers or the programs, the two-hour event would be 90 minutes of free cocktails and awesome buffet, then 30 minutes of speaker.
In the invitations for these things, you know the station wants to say open to decision makers and budget managers only, but they can't. They have to invite everyone at the agency. That's how you wind up with graphic designers chowing down at the radio station-sponsored buffet. They don't have anything to do with buys or budgeting, and they don't even do creative for radio. But the invite did say open to everyone, and there'll be an open bar with hearty appetizers. The radio station has to smile and welcome the freeloaders.
We had a designer at the agency. It was a guy. He's like 24, single. He went to every one of these, every invitation we ever got in from magazines, newspapers, TV stations, radio stations. He would go to every reception and eat. He would eat for free like two or three nights a week. It was amazing.
Saved a lot on his food bill.
Oh, yeah. So Mr. Carlson goes into his office. Jennifer is standing at his desk. She's holding a broken model plane. Art looks around his office. Pictures are crooked on the wall. His bookshelves are a mess. The cushions on the couch have been pulled out. The place is a wreck.
Good golly.
Well, Mr. Carlson, I didn't want you to see your office like this.
Tells Art they've been robbed. She tells him they hit the lobby, too, and she doesn't know what else.
I feel just terrible.
Yeah, so do I.
Mr. Carlson walks over to where his fishing pole should be. He points at the empty place on the wall.
They took my big boss 650 rod and reel. It's gone.
Mr. Carlson stands in shock. Jennifer opens the bottom drawer of his desk.
I'm afraid they took all of your hobby equipment, too.
What?
Your toys.
Jennifer hands the broken plane to Mr. Carlson and tells him she's going to go call the police if she can find a phone left anywhere. Mr. Carlson asks Jennifer who would do this to him.
I doubt if I even know them. I don't think they even know me.
He tells Jennifer...
We could pass on the street without knowing, you know?
Jennifer leaves Carlson's office. Mr. Carlson is left staring at the broken model plane in his hands.
We transition into the bullpen where Bailey has a clipboard in her hands. She's asking people for their lists of things they're missing.
Wonder why they didn't steal any of my awards.
Bailey tells him she doesn't know and asks for his list of whatever was taken. He hands her a piece of paper.
The silver sow alone is invaluable. The fools.
The camera pulls out and we can see that Herb is also there in the bullpen.
Jennifer enters with a list of what was stolen from the lobby and Mr. Carlson's office. She hands some papers to Bailey.
Wow, 2 pages?
Uh-huh. Jennifer tells them all that Mr. Carlson is pretty upset.
Even ordered a burglar alarm system without clearing it with his mother.
She says it will be installed on Friday.
Hold on, hang on a minute here. Wasn't Herb's big shindig also on Friday? Gunselman is weaving a tale.
This is what I'm planning for us this Friday night.
Herb slams his desk drawer shut.
I don't believe this. I had $300 in concert tickets.
300? You told me 200.
He told me 100.
Enos is looking through the DJ desk drawers.
Well, nothing missing in my desk here.
Johnny tells them that he's okay, too. Les looks up from the Pig American magazine that he is reading.
Interesting. And neither of you allegedly heard anything last night, either, did you?
Bailey, irritated, asks Les what he means by that.
Just that it's interesting.
This brings the Pig American back up, his face disappearing behind it.
Herb is standing by Johnny and puts his arm around Johnny's shoulders.
Come on, Les. Johnny's no thief. He's a bum. Venus wouldn't do it because he'd be the first person we suspect.
Herb puts his other arm around Venus's shoulders. Venus gives Herb a dirty look.
Very sensitive of you, Herb.
I know.
Herb pats both of them on their backs, and he heads to his desk.
And I also know that we ought to line these guys up and shoot them right between the eyes.
Johnny and Venus look at each other after this comment. It seems pretty extreme.
Wait a second. You think these people should be killed for a couple hundred bucks worth of office equipment?
Herb says the point is they aren't safe in their own office.
I've been considering... for my own peace of mind and buying a gun.
Nothing dangerous about that, is it?
Modern society as we know it is doomed to a painful and stinking death.
Oh, that's not a good idea. Herb with a gun?
Andy enters the bullpen. He tells Bailey the police are waiting for the list of missing items.
Ellen, add the 50 giveaway radios. They're gone, too.
Oh, no.
I love Johnny's response. Oh, no.
He's so upset.
Yeah.
Bailey tells them the whole thing makes her sick. She drops the stapler she was using onto her desk.
It's like I want to scrub everything before I touch it.
Venus stands up, telling everyone they should be looking on the bright side of this.
Nobody was hurt. Johnny here could have been hit over the head or shot or worse. You know, he was here alone.
Or worse. Johnny is shaken by this realization, and he sits on the desk.
Hadn't thought about it that way.
Venus tells them all it's just a break-in. They happen all the time.
It's our turn. Now, what's the odds of that happening twice? Huh?
Unfortunately, in March of 1981, the odds of it happening twice were pretty good. This turns out to be a very topical show. According to website DisasterCenter.com, burglary in the state of Ohio hit an all-time high in 1981. It had been steadily on the rise since 1960. The 1981 peak saw nearly 161,000 burglaries in a population of 10.8 million. Good news, since 1981, that number has been steadily declining. Was it the impact of this WKRP episode?
I think maybe.
Well, sure, let's say yes. So listen to this drop, though. By 2019, the state of Ohio experienced fewer than 44,000 burglaries in a population of 11.7 million.
Andy tells them that the police suggest they watch themselves at home.
The thieves walked out of here with our entire personnel file. They have our home addresses, the hours we work, and even our salaries. So be careful, Lauren.
Andy takes the list of missing items and leaves the bullpen. Herb looks over and grabs his extendable mirror arm. The mirror is gone.
That settles it. This citizen's angry.
Why would they leave just the arm? The arm is what makes it cool. Without the arm, it's just a mirror.
Yeah, thieves, I don't know.
These thieves are idiots.
They didn't know what they were doing.
Mr. Carlson walks in. He tells them all he has a few words to say about the break-in.
I know how each of you feels. I certainly feel the same way myself.
Art tells them it's frightening to think someone was in their offices last night, but you can't let it change the way you live.
Things have got to get back to normal. That's why I'm asking each of you, including myself, to show up Friday night for Herb's advertising party or reception or whatever the heck it is.
Oh,
God. Herb jumps up, excited, ready to shake Art's hand when you hear moans and groans from throughout the room.
I don't want to go to that thing any more than the rest of you do. Like my mother has said on numerous occasions, the least you can do is try to act normal.
Poor Herb.
Just act normal.
We wanted to do a little something on burglar alarms. We discovered hundreds of burglar alarm companies have included a history of the burglar alarm on their websites. We read through a few and discovered that many don't agree with each other when it comes to the first burglar alarm. Some point to ancient Romans and their use of geese. Honk, honk.
Yeah.
Others mention a guy named Tildesley, who linked chimes to a door lock in the 1700s. If anyone tried to use the wrong skeleton key, the chimes would chime.
Oh, that sounds scary.
Early alarms were pretty lame because they were mechanical. The discovery of electricity seriously advanced the field of burglar alarms.
The sites all agree that in the early 1850s, a Boston Reverend Augustus Russell Pope used electricity, magnets, and a bell to create the first electric burglar alarm. Now you're talking. You had to install one on every window, but they really worked. He patented his idea in 1853. A few years later, Pope was struck down with typhoid. Seriously ill, he sold his patent to Edwin Holmes for $9,500. That's close to $300,000 in today's dollars. Pope died a few days later. Holmes took the idea and ran with it. He set up shop in New York, where crime was bad, which meant business was good.
By 1866, Holmes had installed 1,200 of the Pope-invented devices. He added central monitoring by creating a network of his own construction. Holmes sent his son to Boston to set up the same kind of alarm business. Now, we don't know if Holmes' son was smart or just lazy. He had the bright idea to use existing phone lines rather than run his own wiring. From then on, phone lines and alarm systems would work hand in hand. It was such a great fit. Holmes sold his operation to AT&T in 1905.
Les is reading a copy of Pig American Magazine. We searched for info about Pig American with no luck. We decided to hand it over to Michael Hernandez. Huge thanks are in order. The accountant of Rock tracked down Pig American for us.
He's magical.
He is. It was a real magazine published to a circulation of about 57,000 in the early 1980s. Pig American was published by Watt Publishing in the tiny village of Mount Morris, Illinois. Mount Morris is in northern Illinois, not far from the border with Iowa and some of the most pig populous counties in the world.
The company was founded in 1917 with a single publication, the Poultry Tribune, which was also the original company name. By 1940, the Poultry Tribune had grown to a circulation of 500,000.
I had to double check that number. When I came across that number, I'm like, hold on, is that for real? 500,000 chicken people.
That's a lot of chicken people. Other ag-related titles were added to the company lineup. To reflect this expansion into areas other than poultry, the corporate name was changed to Watt Publishing in 1944 after founder J.W. Watt.
Okay, I'm going to try to get through this. Pig American was not Watt's only pig-themed publication. By the 80s, their 18 ag industry titles also included
Pig International. It was in English, but summaries were translated into Spanish, German, French, Italian, Japanese, and Chinese. For Hispanic hog operations, Watt published Industria Porcina. Now imagine for a moment Les Nessman reading a publication about pigs in Spanish.
What is it you call the little Mexican dogs?
Chihuahuas?
Watt was acquired by publishing giant Global Media in 2014 when they were rebranded Watt Global Media. Greg Watt, the fourth generation of Watts at the helm, is still CEO of the division, and he was on hand to help celebrate their 100th anniversary in 2017.
So Greg Watt would be the head hog?
He's the head hog.
We go to the lobby. Jennifer and Mr. Carlson are standing by the entrance to the lobby where a burglar alarm has been installed on the wall.
Now, by throwing this switch, the system is fully activated.
Mr. Carlson is listening closely. He asks if it's the blue switch.
No, the green one.
And she flips it. A red light comes on.
Now, we are tied into the police station through the phone lines, where an alarm goes off if anyone opens that door.
Herb comes walking through the lobby from the bullpen. He has both hands full with items needed for the party.
See y'all for tonight.
Herb heads to the main door to leave. Mr. Carlson rushes over to open the door for Herb.
Now hold on a minute. Didn't Jennifer just say...
8 o'clock, right?
Right.
And, of course, the alarm sounds. Art begins pushing Art begins pushing buttons in a panic on the control panel, but it continues to blare. Jennifer gets on the phone as fast as she can to the police.
Hello, officer. This is WKRP. We're just testing the system again.
She quickly hangs up the phone and runs to shut off the alarm.
Mr. Carlson asks Jennifer if she knows why he ordered the alarm system. He seems to really be wanting an answer.
Certainly not because you're surrendering to urban paranoia.
No.
Since we're also talking about Mr. Carlson...
And not because it's just a great big fun toy.
No?
There has to be another reason.
You installed it because it's a reasonable response to an unreasonable situation.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There it is. Jennifer and Mr. Carlson return to the alarm system lesson.
Now, where were we?
Fully activated, I believe.
Okay.
Jennifer takes Art's thumb and puts it on the switch. Together, they activate the system. Jennifer repeats, if anyone opens the door, an alarm sounds here and at the police station, and help is on the way. And a little bit of the fun of doing this live, Art kind of reached over very calmly and closed the door. It was standing open when she set
the
alarm.
Oh, the door to the lobby, yes.
Yeah, the lobby door.
It was kind of open a little bit.
Push it shut just a bit there. She then shows him a phone number to call if the alarm goes off by mistake. That's when Johnny and Venus enter the lobby. They have a good look at the alarm system.
Looks like a fun toy.
Well, it isn't. That happens to be an unreasonable response to a reasonable situation.
Art looks proudly at Jennifer.
We transition to a banquet room in the Cricket at the base of the Flim building. We hear Venus on the air because they're playing WKRP live over the sound system.
At 8:30, this is Venus on WKRP providing the musical score to your life.
We see Herb and Mr. Carlson by the refreshment table. There's a great shot of the banner which reads WKRP Sales Success. A couple of the S's are dollar signs.
Yeah, real subtle there, Herb.
Bailey and Les are sitting at a table. Johnny and Jennifer are at the bar. All of them are wearing name tags, except for Johnny. We have a bartender and a coat check girl working the party just the way Herb described it to the big guy. Andy is leaning on the coat check door, flirting with the coat check girl. No one else is there. Mr. Carlson tells Herb if no one else is going to show, he'd like to get home. He's worried about this family being home alone.
Johnny tells Herb to let Art go. Herb points at Johnny.
Where's your name tag?
He ate it. I saw him.
Herb walks over to Bailey and Les. He asks them if at least they're having fun.
Honestly, Herb, when it's 10 o'clock, I am gone.
They're just all marking time till they can get out of there. Herb asks if she has something more important to do. Well, the break-in has them all on edge. She said her plans are go home and sit by the phone listening to scary noises. Jennifer says it's kind of the same thing at her house.
Can I go home too, Herb?
Herb tells them all to wait just 1 minute.
Didn't you people pay attention the other day to the stirring words of the big guy? We were asked to act normal.
He plans to stay right here and try his darndest to do just that.
Herb act normal.
My guess that Travis will be right beside me. Right, Andy?
Herb taps Andy on his back.
Get away from me, Herb.
The coat check girl asks Andy who that was.
Oh, Miss Nobody. Now, where were we?
Well, you were telling me how you first got interested in radio.
That's right.
So the coat check girl, Stella, is being played by Kelly Grier. When Herb said a short skirt on the coat check girl, he was not kidding. As we'll see in a couple of scenes, Kelly had some legs, but she wasn't able to turn them into a career. This is one of only two credits for Kelly, both coming in 1981. Her only other listing was a movie. A horrible, horrible movie. She had a minor role in 1981's Force 5. Poetically, Force 5 is currently rated at a 5 out of 10 stars. Ouch. On IMDb. Yeah, that's below an F. It starred Joe Louis as a martial arts expert leading a team of four other martial artists against an island full of bad guys.
Oh, my.
The tagline sums up just how bad this thing was. 5 against 1,000. The odds are even. I'm sure a lot of stuff exploded in that movie, too.
Johnny stands up and heads to the door.
Your party was perverse.
Wait, John.
I don't think that was a compliment. Herb runs after him, telling him to wait.
I promised them that a celebrity would be here.
Use less, okay?
Herb makes a face. Johnny's going upstairs to get a little sleep. He's got to pull the all-night shift again. Herb puts his arm around Johnny's shoulders.
If you'll promise to stay just for a few more minutes, I'll tell you something that could save your life.
Johnny nods his head, saying sure.
Herb looks around. He wants to make sure nobody's too close. He doesn't want him hearing this.
Okay, now I know you're going to be on the air all alone tonight. So today I bought a gun.
What?
It's in my desk if you need it. Top left drawer, and it's loaded.
Herb picks up a finger sandwich from the table and hands it to Johnny.
Have a nice time at the party.
Herb sees a woman walk into the room.
Ah, welcome, welcome.
I'm with Brady and Silver.
Oh, Herb smiles and shakes her hand as he introduces himself.
Well, I'm Herb Tarlick, Executive Sales Manager, WKRP, and you are?
Hilda. I run the mailroom at the agency.
Oops. Herb wilts as Hilda walks over to the food table.
Hilda is being played by Linda Rand. Before we get into Linda's info, we found an error on IMDb. If you check the cast list for this episode, it lists this character's name as Helga. Sorry, IMDb. She very clearly says Hilda.
Hilda.
Hear that?
Hilda.
It's pretty clear.
Hilda. I run the mailroom at the agency.
Okay, now let's talk about the lady playing Hilda. Sometimes credited as Linda L. Rand, this appearance on WKRP was Linda's first of 12 acting credits. She was born in L.A. in 1946. She would go on to land several acting jobs in the 80s on shows like Golden Girls,
My Two Dads,
Murder, She Wrote,
and Knight Rider. Did you know there was a reboot of the Dragnet series in 1989? Neither did we. It lasted 2 seasons, and Linda was able to score an episode on there, too. Linda did land a small movie role in 1986. She played a guard in the seedy and scandalous Tom DeSimone cult classic Reform School Girls. Linda Rand passed away in January of 2019 at her home in California.
Hilda.
We transition into the studio. The lights are low, and we've got a quick poster watch.
Yep.
Venus must do his own decorating for nighttime, we see a brand new poster on the door that wasn't there earlier in the day. It's a blow-up of a Jet magazine cover featuring a picture of Lena Horne. Lena Horne was an American dancer, singer, actress, and civil rights activist. Born in 1917, her career spanned 70 years. Lena Horne died in May of 2010 at the age of 92. This poster was taken from the cover of the Jet magazine issue, dated August 21st of 1980. Incidentally, it went for a dollar at the newsstand.
In the studio, Venus is at the mic.
Now, let's take a look at Venus's vibin' threads.
Venus is wearing a red silky shirt, unbuttoned to the fourth button, tucked into a pair of plum-colored leather pants, with a thin black belt and a gold buckle. He has on a black vest with gold bead edging all around. He has a gold bracelet on his right wrist and two gold chain necklaces around his neck.
We hear the intro to Just the Two of Us by Bill Withers and Grover Washington Jr.
Venus is here, my children, always close by. And through the heaviness of a lonely night, there's just the two of us. As in Bill Withers and Grover Washington Jr.
Venus is logging the song when the burglar alarm sounds. Venus looks around, worried but not quite sure what to do. Suddenly, the alarm stops.
Bill Withers was a U.S. singer-songwriter who found his greatest success in the early 70s. This single was a later in his career surprise hit. Grover Washington Jr. is an American jazz saxophonist who was one of the founders of the smooth jazz movement. Just the Two of Us was co-written by Withers, and he also does the vocals.
Just the two of us, we can make it if we try.
It originally appeared on Washington's 1980 album, Wine Light, with a runtime of 7:23. A single version edited for time would go to number 2 on the Hot 100 for 3 weeks in February of 1981. This was Washington's only top 40 hit of his career.
Venus goes to the door of the studio and flips the lights on. He opens the door to the hallway where it's dark. As Venus steps into the hallway, we've got a hallway poster watch.
Yay! When Venus opens the door, there's a great shot of that freaky-looking line-drawn poster. It's white on black of what looks like a guy in a tuxedo. This is cover art from the debut 1980 album by Gary Myrick and the Figures. We heard the cut She Talks in Stereo in the Real Families episode. A big thanks to Michael Hernandez, the accountant of Rock, for giving us the details on that poster.
Below the Gary Myrick poster, you can just catch the top edge of a promo poster for Blondie's 5th studio album, Auto American. It was released in November of 1980. It included the singles Rapture and The Tide is High. Auto American will peak at number 7 on the U.S. album chart.
When Venus crosses the hall, he stops in front of the door leading into the bullpen. We can clearly see Nicolette Larson on the door in a poster promoting her January of 1981 release, Radioland. This is the 3rd studio album from Miss Larson. 3 singles will be released, Ooh-wee, How Can We Go On, and Radioland. None will make the Hot 100. The album does peak at number 62 on the Billboard album chart.
Venus hears a noise from the bullpen. He slowly opens the bullpen door just a crack. Bending over, he peeks in. Johnny quietly walks up behind Venus and leans over his shoulder, also peeking in the door. Venus has no idea Johnny's there until...
What's happening?
Venus shuts the door and looks at Johnny.
Don't you miss? You take it easy. I think I hurt myself.
Venus asks Johnny if he's the one who set off the alarm. Johnny tells him no, the door was unlocked when he came in.
There's another noise from the bullpen. Johnny and Venus both look at the closed door. Johnny opens the door, sticks his head into the bullpen, and sees the main glass doors still swinging as if someone had just left the room.
We cut back into the studio where the lights are once again turned low. Venus is on the phone. We hear he's talking to the police. Johnny's nervously looking out the studio window.
This is no false alarm, officer. No, we... Yeah, right. Well, but look, I'm not kidding around this time. But look, it was...
Venus slams the phone down. Venus walks over and flips on the lights. It sounds like Carlson cried wolf one too many times with the new alarm. When the lights come on, Johnny quickly runs over and stands with his back to the door, flat up against Lena.
So now what?
Johnny suggests they check the station to see if there's anybody out there who shouldn't be.
Yeah, and they shouldn't be.
That's a good point.
Johnny walks over to Venus.
Herb told me something today in the strictest of confidence.
He's got a gun in his desk.
Johnny says Herb told him he was the only person he told.
I heard about it from Les.
And I was thinking, oh, well, sure, Herb would have told Les, but you brought up an interesting point.
I think Les knew because I think he just keeps an eye on the...
Whatever's in
desk drawers
Herb's
of Herb's.
Desk. He's always going through his desk.
Yeah, he knows because in that one episode you said it was
out to lunch.
He listed off, you know, boom.
Yeah, he gave the whole inventory of everything in Herb's drawer. So you're thinking he was just snooping and told Venus about the gun.
That's what I think.
Venus doesn't want to go get the gun. Johnny tells Venus he's the Vietnam vet. He's the one who has experience with weapons.
I swore I'd never touch another gun, man. I don't want to shoot anybody.
They both decide they might be getting a little carried away. Johnny wonders why the robbers would come back anyway. Venus agrees, saying everything of value has already been stolen.
Of course, it has been replaced.
Brand new stuff.
Oh, yeah, there is that. They look at each other.
Well, Johnny comes up with an idea.
We could get the gun and unload it. That's safe, huh?
Yeah, guess we could then check out the station.
Yeah, we're just paranoid. I know I am.
They both laugh nervously.
Just noise, false alarm.
Yeah.
They look at each other again and then look at the studio door. Venus motions with his head, and they both walk toward the door. We cut to a view from the hallway where we see the studio door swing open wide. And then there's a few beats. Then Venus comes walking out quickly. He turns to look behind him, but Johnny isn't following. Venus goes back to the studio door, and he motions for Johnny to come on.
They cross the darkened hallway, and now they're standing at the bullpen door when Venus turns to Johnny.
I was just thinking.
Me too.
Venus says if there is anybody in there, and they have a loaded gun... And whoever it is sees them with their gun?
Right, we shouldn't unload ours, right?
Yeah, probably not. We want to unload it.
You pick up a gun, you better be ready to use it.
There's a noise at the other end of the hallway. It makes them both jump.
Top drawer, right. You said left.
Venus and Johnny hurry through the door into the bullpen.
I don't want to shoot anybody.
Back at the cricket, the party is very quiet. There's no music playing from the speakers when they did have Venus's show on. We see Les in a heated discussion with a young man wearing a suit and round wire-rimmed glasses.
All of society will be crushed under the massive weight of man's basic disrespect for his fellow man.
Ergo the testament of John Donne. Send not to know for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee. What bell?
And he might be one of those graphic artists I was talking about there for free food. I don't see him being a guy placing a budget.
Mr. Carlson approaches Jennifer and Bailey, who are sitting at a table.
Excuse me, did you notice something strange?
The kid with the round glasses?
Yeah. Huh? No music. It's unlike Venus to mess up.
The kid in the wire-rimmed glasses is being played by Robert O'Donnell. In the closing credits, he's called the intellectual. But we've just been referring to him as the kid in the wire-rimmed glasses. Keeping with the trend in the third season of hiring unknown and inexperienced actors, this is a very first credit for Robert O'Donnell. He will go on to rack up a total of 4 acting credits. He'll get this one in 1981. Then he gets a guest shot on Making the Great in 1982 and an episode of Simon and Simon in 1983. His part on Simon and Simon is listed as computer geek all the way back in 1983. Robert disappears from the acting scene until 1999. That year, he has a small part in the movie Man on the Moon. That's the Jim Carrey movie about comedian Andy Kaufman. Robert is one of the members of Hera's band. So that would be the house band at Hera's Casino.
The wire-rimmed glasses kid was quoting a famous line from the English poet, scholar, soldier, cleric, and noted reverend, John Donne. His name is pronounced Donne, but it is spelled D-O-N-N-E. Donne lived from January of 1572 until March of 1631. His writing was considered coarse and revolutionary, and he was second only to Shakespeare when it came to his literary importance. Donne criticized English society, and he wrote roughly as a reaction to the smoothness of Elizabethan poetry.
The line quoted to Les, "For whom the bell tolls," is one of Donne's most famous passages. It was written later in his life after he'd had a very serious fever. It's not from a poem. The line was included in a book of meditations, which were written in prose. It is his most famous, but also most misquoted passage. The line at the start of the same meditation, number 17, is his other most famous quote, "No man is an island entire of itself." The end of the passage is where he references the bell. You usually hear that one misquoted as, "Ask not for whom the bell tolls." That is wrong.
I feel so scholarly
yes,
now.
Yes, quite literary.
We're in the land of academia. The kid says it correctly. Send not or never send. The bell he's referring to is the funeral bell. Donne is saying when you hear a funeral bell, don't wonder who died. He is reminding us we are all a part of society. Any death is a tragic loss to all of society and affects all of us equally. This is why any funeral bell tolls for thee. If you back up just a few words, the quote starts, "Any man's death diminishes me because I am involved in mankind." The title of Ernest Hemingway's novel about the Spanish Civil War, For Whom the Bell Tolls, was inspired by Donne's quote.
And everybody listening just got 3 credits in English.
Class is dismissed.
Yes, there'll be a quiz on Friday.
The tolls for thee!
A smiling Herb comes up to Art.
Excuse me, big guy. I've got 2 real agency VIPs. They want to talk to the man in charge.
Art smiles back and stands up straighter.
Well, have you seen Andy?
Whoops. Art's smile becomes a frown as he stares at Herb.
Did I say Andy? I meant Artie. May I call you Artie?
This is a callback to Turkey's Away. Herb had the same slip of the tongue then.
Previous management had things pretty well screwed up around here. No offense.
We're now in the lobby where all the lights are out, but the main door is standing wide open. Venus and Johnny come walking in. They're both doing a crouch walk. Venus is holding the gun out in front of him. They're both looking back and forth as they creep in. Venus accidentally bumps into Johnny.
Don't point that thing, man. It scares. Well, you want to take it, fine.
Johnny tells Venus he didn't say that.
Well, it's your turn, man.
As they are arguing, they hear a noise inside Mr. Carlson's office.
One of us just turned pale.
Johnny begins walking away.
Man, when we started this, I didn't think we were going to find him. But Venus is bad planning.
Mr. Carlson comes in the main doors.
What's going on here?
He flips the lights on as he enters. Les is following Art. Johnny jumps up on a small table.
He was startled.
Oh, that was so funny. He jumps up on this table between the filing cabinets as Venus holds his hands up, making the shushing sound.
Yeah, Johnny's reaction, being scared and jumping up on the filing cabinets, it makes the scene hilarious.
So Mr. Carlson is yelling at them. He walks over to Venus as he's hollering.
Shut up.
What are you shushing me for?
Venus is pointing his thumb at Art's closed office door.
Thieves are back in there in your office. We got him cornered.
Johnny is still perched up on the table.
But he's got him cornered. Les takes his glasses off and puts them in his shirt pocket.
That settles it. There's three of us, including Johnny.
Who is he counting? There are four of them in the room.
I don't know. Suddenly, Les has become James Cagney from a 30s gangster movie.
We got the rod.
The rod?
Sure, rod, piece, gat, iron, heater, Roscoe, pedals, grill.
They all look at Les and they don't notice the door to Mr. Carlson's office has opened. Les hits the floor, face down. Venus swings around, leveling the gun at the open doorway. Johnny's behind Venus and Mr. Carlson is behind Johnny. It happens fast and everyone is on edge.
It's Andy, Venus. Put the gun down.
I'm white knuckling it over here.
Venus is frozen. The gun is pointing right at Andy's head.
Put the gun down.
Venus uncocks the gun and lowers it.
Ooh, tense.
That was tense.
And wow, you don't really get a feel for how big the gun her bought is until Venus has it pointed in Andy's face. Any gun experts out there, let us know what you think this thing is. It is a big one, possibly a .357. I'm no expert. So if you know what gun they're using, post it to the Facebook page or write us WKRPcast@gmail.com.
Andy has pressed himself flat against the wall next to Mr. Carlson's door. His eyes are wide and he's breathing heavily.
What are you guys doing? Pulling the leg of the old program director here.
Venus looks at Andy.
Sorry, Andy, man.
Venus is speechless and he's feeling awful. Johnny puts his hand on Venus's back.
I told you not to play around with guns.
Oh, well, shut it, man!
Still having trouble breathing, Andy asks if that's a real gun.
Yeah, it is.
It's not loaded.
Yes, it is.
Oh, God.
Andy points a finger at Venus.
You aimed that at me.
Mr. Carlson tries to say something.
Travis, I think that...
And he then says the greatest program director line he's ever uttered on the whole show.
No DJ has ever pointed a gun at me before. Not at any station I've ever worked. Oh, sure. I mean, we've had some problems before. But...
Yeah, we had some problems, but... So Andy sits on Jennifer's desk trying to catch his breath when we hear a muffled female voice coming from Mr. Carlson's office asking, what's going on out there? Art leans down close to Andy.
Travis, who's in my office?
Busted.
He just had a gun pulled on him. Give him a break.
The door to Carlson's office opens and Stella, the coat check girl, comes out with a drink in her hand, smiling at them all.
Oh, hi. Has the party moved up here?
Ladies and gentlemen, meet Stella and Stella's legs.
Woof. It's a short skirt.
It's not even worthy of being called a skirt. Les puts his hands on his hips.
Oh, well, woo, woo, woo. Everybody meet Stella. She's right there.
Well, Andrew was just showing me his office.
Andy puts his head in his hand.
Do all these people work for you?
Andy begins running his hands through his hair. Mr. Carlson turns to Andy.
Andy. Mr. Travis.
Andy walks over to Mr. Carlson, tucking his shirt back into his pants as he does.
I love the little detail of the shirt being tucked back in. What was going on in Art's office?
I suggest that you have one of your employees get a record on the air. You may be forced to fire your program director.
So Andy nods his head and walks to the door leading to the bullpen. Venus jumps up.
I'm sorry, Andy. Man, I wasn't going to shoot you. I was going to shoot... Damn!
It's my fault, too, Trap.
We'll chat about this later, all right? I'll put the record on. It gives me a great excuse to leave the room.
Andy heads to the door once more when Stella grabs his arm.
Should I go with you or wait in your office?
Andy pulls her along with him through the door, leading back to the studio.
Les sits down in Jennifer's chair. Venus goes over to Mr. Carlson, and he begins apologizing.
Then unload that thing, will you?
Venus opens the chamber of the gun and empties the bullets into his hand.
No better than this, man.
Well, I think we were both more affected by the robbery than we thought.
Yeah, I got carried away, yeah.
Carlson tells them he thinks they all did.
Not me.
I've been expecting the downfall of modern society.
Les is smiling at them all.
I think you missed it, Les. It already happened.
That could be the case, Venus. However, I refuse to give up faith in my fellow man.
Jennifer comes through the main doors.
Well, here's where everybody's hiding.
Jennifer walks quickly over to Art.
I really hope you're in the mood for a surprise.
Mr. Carlson tells her he really doesn't think he's in the mood.
I think I can speak for everybody.
Too bad. While you were all up here doing heaven knows what, downstairs at the party, somebody took off with all the coats and purses.
Mr. Carlson puts his hand up to his head.
Oh, jeez. We got nobody to blame but ourselves.
Herb enters the lobby. He sees everyone standing in the lobby. They all turn to look at him. He begins walking quickly to the door leading to the bullpen.
And on the other hand,
Mr. Carlson takes off after Herb, chasing him through the door. Johnny puts his arm around Venus's shoulder and the screen fades to black.
There was a point that we discussed and we wanted to mention at the end here. When the guys peek into the bullpen and when it's in the dark and the door is swinging, now know that that was Andy that was in there. But we were trying to figure out why would he have been back there in the bullpen.
And then we decided it was probably because he was in Herb's drawer getting some booze to share with Stella.
Didn't that end when Herb had his issues on Out to Lunch? I didn't figure Herb would still have booze in his desk. So maybe they're keeping something in the DJ's desk. I'm wondering about that.
I don't know.
Yeah, but Andy was in the bullpen retrieving cocktails, most likely. And that's why the door swung.
Do all these people work for you?
And hey, there's something a little different happening in the credits. Up until now, if we had guest stars in an episode, you'd see the performer's name in the post-roll credit list, and that would be it. It would say with or also with, and then just list the performer's names. This time, we not only get guest star names, we also have identifiers for their characters. So it says, Kelly was the coat check girl, Linda was the mailroom manager, and so on.
And yeah, we know this was a big message episode about the dangers of owning a handgun, gun violence, that kind of thing. It doesn't really say anything one way or the other, and it does portray this kind of situation in a realistic way, but it comes across as a political statement. The only review on IMDb slams this episode for being a liberal anti-gun message. We all have our own opinions, so we're just going to let the episode speak for itself on the political front.
So that's going to do it for Nothing to Fear But. Donna, what is up for next week?
Next week, we're going to be discussing Till Debt Do Us Part. Johnny welcomes the chance to end his alimony payments until he meets his ex-wife's intended.
And his ex-wife's intended is being played by Hamilton Camp. We get Hamilton Camp again. And there's a great story to go along with how Hamilton wound up back on the episode. That's going to wrap things up for this week's episode of the WKRP Cast. If you'd like to watch along with us, make sure to check our show notes. You can find us on social media. Follow our Facebook page at WKRP Cast. For more WKRP fun, become a patron. Go to patreon.com/WKRPcast for behind-the-scenes fun, full interviews, and more.
Got a question, comment, or correction? Let us know about it. Write us, WKRPcast@gmail.com.
And remember to please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Thanks for listening.
Bye now.
May the good news be yours.
The WKRP Cast is not endorsed by MTM Enterprises, Shout Factory, or CBS. This podcast is intended for entertainment and informational purposes only. WKRP in Cincinnati, the WKRP logo, and all names, pictures, and audio of WKRP in Cincinnati characters are registered trademarks of MTM, CBS, Shout Factory, or their respective copyright holders.
Almost forgot, fellow babies. Booger!